From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea, in for Celeste Headley. You ever get nostalgic for the good old days?
Memories like the corners of my mind.
Today we're going to talk about how a longing for the past has set the stage for Donald Trump's surprising popularity. Then a celebration of days gone by with a dedicated group of pin collectors who have met for 20 years to keep an Olympic tradition alive in Atlanta. And we're going to hear about one man's mission to preserve a forgotten part of cinema's golden age. That's coming up this hour, but first, it's been two decades since Atlanta hosted the 1996 Summer Olympics. We look back on yesterday's show at how the city was changed by the Games. Former NPR correspondent Kathy Lohr covered the Games for the network, and she joined us on the show yesterday.
People were thrilled to have the Olympics here. It was a time of really city pride, spirit, and people were excited about having all these people coming into the city to see Atlanta, that Atlanta would be this spark. It was a sparkling moment.
We wanted to hear your memories of the 1996 Atlanta Olympics and the lasting influence that the Games had on the city. Here are your first thoughts.
My name is Ralph Parker from Marietta. During the Olympics in 1996, we had the opportunity to host the team from the Maldives, and then we were able to do a reception at our house, which was absolutely wonderful. Had a chance to go into the Olympic Village with Maldivian credentials, and had a chance to meet Muhammad Ali. Amazing experience.
Vince, Marietta, Georgia. I was 13 when the Olympic torch was lit 20 years ago today, and I can still remember the feeling of excitement, the butterflies, and just knowing that Atlanta would never be the same.
And Margaret Keller tweets, "My ex-husband and I were standing where the bomb went off 1 hour before. We were tired and walked to the train. Yikes, just missed it." Barry Hollander tweets, "We had a 2- and a 3-year-old at the time. There were Olympics." I hear you, Barry. We always want to find out what you think. Call us at 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio, and we might feature your comments on the show. A significant demographic change has happened since Barack Obama first ran for president in 2008. White Christians went from making up 54% of the country to now it's less than half. My guest today argues that this decline is important for understanding today's political landscape, from the political success of Donald Trump to heated rhetoric over the nation's top social issues. Robert Jones is the CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute. He's also the author of the new book, The End of White Christian America. Robert joins us now from Washington. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, is there a qualitative judgment implied in your work? Are you lamenting the decline of white Christian America? Are you celebrating it, or are you merely describing it?
Yeah. Well, you know, PRI, of which I'm the CEO, is a nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization. And really in the book, I try to be fairly circumspect about this really massive event in the country's life. And, you know, I begin the book with an obituary where I kind of personify white Christian America and talk about its death, a little bit tongue in cheek, but I think laying out some important realities. But I end the book with a eulogy where I kind of imagine myself presiding over this very complicated death. And if you think about, you know, a kind of complicated death in the family where you have some people who are very close to the deceased and really grieving this loss, but then you have maybe other people who had more complicated relationships, maybe even conflictual relationships, who are, you know, more than happy to say good riddance, and then some other people in between. And I think that's the tone of the book, is really trying to describe this really new reality that the country has entered into, and the very different reactions that different factions in the country are having to it.
People talk a lot about the decline of white America, or rather the more often the rise of non-white America. People talk about the decline of religiosity in America. Why look at white Christians together? You could look at white people, you could look at Christians. Why white Christians?
Well, that's a really insightful question. I mean, I think that is the key to really understanding this cultural shift. I mean, you know, from you know, the beginning of the country, I think it's important to remember the power not just that white Christianity had, but white Protestant Christianity had. You know, in the country, you know, we look back at if you look at the early, you know, constitutional Congress and members of Congress early in the country, all the way through really the middle of the 20th century, it was really white Protestants that had power in the country. There's this great line in one of the books as I was doing research by historians said, put it this way, if you were in charge of something big and important all the way up through the middle of the 20th century, chances are you were white, male, and Protestant.
Right. It's been only recently that we've even really lumped Protestants and Catholics together. It's only been recently that I feel like Catholics have been accepted into the concept of whiteness as it really functions in America.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, you don't have to go back that far to look at census forms, and you see things like if you were an Irish Catholic, you know, you were classified as a Celt. For example, on census forms, not Caucasian, and that's not that far back there in our country's history. The, you know, extreme amount of questioning that President Kennedy had to face in 1960, even as we're headed to the second half of the 20th century, about whether he would answer to the Vatican, you know, as if he were elected president, and those were like questions poised by, you know, Protestant ministers with deep, deep concerns about this, you know, pretty late. That's just a few decades ago.
In your book, you talk about three waves of white Protestant resurgence over American history. Do you want to give us the dime tour of all three?
Sure. Yeah. You know, one way I do this is through actually a little tour of buildings at the beginning of the book. And I sort of use them again as kind of stand-ins or metaphors for the larger thing. So, you know, one interesting building I'm here in Washington, D.C. is a United Methodist building that is the only religious building on Capitol Hill. It's a triangular building. And if you look out one window, you see the U.S. Capitol. You look out the other window and you see the U.S. Supreme Court building. And it is literally, you know, a stone's throw away from both of those buildings. And when it was the money was being raised for that building, it was built by one single mainline Protestant denomination, the Methodist, and it was built to be a sentinel on Capitol Hill, right, to keep a watchful eye. It was the largest denomination in the country at the time, to keep a watchful eye on Congress. That's the kind of first wave. I think is like just a single denomination really exerting that kind of power and believing that it could exert that kind of power over national politics. And then the second wave was more of an ecumenical movement, mostly around the more liberal end of the mainline Protestant world, so Episcopalians and Presbyterians and the Methodists, realizing that they needed to kind of band together and building this big building called the Intercultural Center in New York City, sometimes called the God Box in New York City. Big limestone-clad structure, land, and a lot of money donated by John D. Rockefeller Jr. to build this edifice. And it really was about also, and to kind of tie to the other comments, built to push back on what it saw as twin threats to the Republic. And that was communism and secularism on the one hand, but the other one was Catholicism, and built to kind of exert kind of Protestant dominance. And then the third wave really hits in the 1980s and 90s as the mainline Protestant denominations begin to wane in the 70s and 80s. We see this rising crest of the white evangelical Protestant world, the more conservative end. And the building I kind of isolate there is this. Amazing building built outside of L.A., the Crystal Cathedral, built by the ministry of Robert Schuller, that in its heyday, you know, was on TV all the time. And this building was built with 10,000 panes of glass and was called by the New York Times at its opening, perhaps the most important religious building since the Cathedral of Notre Dame was erected in Paris. What's interesting about it is that, you know, by the first decade of the 21st century, that ministry had gone bankrupt. They ended up having to sell the building. And who buys the building? But the Catholic Church buys the building. And it is now a multi-ethnic, multilingual Catholic cathedral in that same space.
We're talking to Robert Jones. He's the author of the new book, The End of White Christian America. Catching us up now to the present day, Robert. Is the decline of white Christian America the result of something that's happening within the white Christian demographic, or is it merely that demographic is being outnumbered by the influx and rise of other kinds of people?
It's facing both internal and external factors. So externally, certainly the things that the Census Bureau has been talking about, that, you know, the year 2042 now is the year that the country will be a majority non-white country, sometimes called a majority, you know, majority minority with quotes country. But that's still out on the horizon a little bit. But that's certainly a factor, declining white population overall. The other contributing factor to that external piece are declining birth rates among whites, certainly lower birth rates compared to non-whites in the country, and immigration patterns, where we've had growing numbers of immigrants, particularly from Mexico and Latin America, that have begun to change the face of the American populace. But that alone would not get us to where we are today. The other important thing that I think has just not been put together with these demographic shifts are the large number of white Christians who have left Christian churches over the last few decades. So if you just go back to the 1990s, the number of religiously unaffiliated people in the country were less than 1 in 10. Today, that number is 23%. Nearly a quarter of the country claims no religious affiliation. And if you look at young people, it's more than a third who claim no religious affiliation at all. So it's these external combination of external and internal factors that have really given us this shift where we've crossed this threshold from being a majority white Christian country to a minority white Christian country just in the last 8 years.
And is secularism rising faster in white America than in non-white America?
Yes. I mean, so, you know, it's important to say that this kind of rise in the unaffiliated has been almost entirely due to, white flight from Christian churches, that we see that African-American Protestants have basically held their own over the last few decades. And actually, if you look at Latino Christians, that number has actually been growing over time. So it really is this story of kind of white Christians leaving churches and becoming nothing, really, claiming no religious affiliation.
We asked people in Midtown Atlanta about what the decline of white Christians will mean for the country. Here's what a fellow named Kevin Campbell had to say.
The morality will change. Things that were once taboo will not be anymore. For instance, the political correctness. Everybody's upset because they can't, say what they mean without offending anyone anymore. But it's like, those things were always offensive. They just, nobody spoke up about it before. And now that there's less white Christians, I guess, then people feel more empowered to speak their minds.
Now, he mentions their political correctness, which is something that the Trump campaign brings up over and over and over and over again. Robert, do you think that is part of the appeal for white Christian voters who are supporting Trump? And what does it mean?
Yeah. Well, I should say that it's important to note that nowhere in my book do I mention Trump. The book was actually wrapped about the time that Trump announced his candidacy, when no one was really taking it all that seriously.
You had foresight.
Yeah. So but I do think it casts some really interesting light on what's going on here. So, one part of kind of the attack of political correctness is always has a nostalgic ring to it. Right. That it used to be that we could just say what we think, but now we can't.
Yes.
Because there's this changing America. We're going to offend someone, as this person said. But to kind of identify and isolate this sense of nostalgia, I think, is really important, because I think that this is a very powerful emotion arising from this sense of vulnerability and change, and this realization that, to kind of, again, take this metaphor of white Christian America, that kind of cultural and political edifice that was built by white Protestant Christians, that for most of the nation's history really did set the tone for our conversation, shaped our ideals, controlled its institutions, that as that moves from the center to the periphery, I think white Christians find themselves in a very different place, where the conversations they used to be able to have in their own circles, and not have to worry too much about assumptions or stereotypes. Now,
Robert, hold that thought, Robert. Yeah. We got to take a break. We're going to be back in a minute with Robert Wood. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headlee. The End of White Christian America is a new book by my guest, Robert Jones. He's the CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute in Washington, D.C. He has traced the rise of white Christians as a powerful demographic group and how that rise is now reversed. It's been losing some ground in American politics. And before the break, Robert, you were talking about the nostalgia that is really being expressed, embodied by the entire thesis of the Trump campaign, Make America Great Again. The criticism of that white Christian nostalgia for the way things used to be is, things were great for you white Christians back in the day. That's because you lived at the expense of all the rest of us. And now that we're getting a seat at the table, you're mad that you're having to share. Does that seem like a fair critique to you, or did America do pretty well under white Christian hegemony?
Well, you know, I think it's important to say that we have a lot of contributions from this world, you know, hospitals, civic institutions, the YMCA. I mean, all these institutions really came out of this world. But I do think this sense of nostalgia is a dangerous one, really, for the country. And it's pretty powerful in this group. So just to give you one number here, when we asked a survey of Americans whether you think that American culture and way of life has gotten changed for the better or changed for the worse since the 1950s. The country as a whole is evenly divided on this question. But when we look at white evangelical Protestants, we find that like 7 in 10 say it has changed for the worse. And so this is the group that really forms a core of surprising core, really, of Donald Trump's support. And I think what's happened there is that Trump has really succeeded in converting these kind of self-described values voters in past elections into nostalgia voters in this election.
Let's talk about the South and where you could say that maybe the group that we're talking about today, white Christians, still retains considerable power. Maybe not so much. Certainly here in Atlanta, white Christians have to share a lot of the power with people who aren't white. How do you see this trend manifesting in the Southern United States?
Yeah. Well, I'm from Mississippi. I did my graduate work at Emory University, and actually my 1996 moment was actually moving to Atlanta to start my graduate program there. But you know what? Here's what I think is different in the white South today. That you know, even if you go back, you know, to the Jim Crow era, certainly before that, you had this sort of assumption, I think, among many Southern white Christians that that really their values were still in many ways central to the country's identity, right? So even if they knew that there were African Americans who they were often in tension with, there was still this sense that they really still had a hold on power in the country. And what's different today, I think, and why we see this very defensive posture among many white, especially white conservative Christians, is that they have this real sense, you know, it's also, remember, if we look at the same period, only 4 in 10 Americans supported gay marriage, for example, in 2008, just two election cycles ago. Today, that number is 53%. So if you look at just that bellwether issue, it's such a visible indicator that for those conservative white Christians who were kind of all in opposing this issue, that the country has really moved on to a different place. And so I think the thing is really different is even if you live in an enclave, you know, in kind of a white Christian enclave in Cobb County, it's not so easy to think that the rest of the country still resonates with your values. You increasingly sort of understand yourself as a minority. And I think it's that sense of vulnerability that kind of fuels this strong kind of visceral reactions that we see sometimes to our politics and this strong sense of nostalgia.
Right. Majority and dominance are related but distinct concepts. You can have a minority that is nonetheless dominant. But we're heading to a point here where white Christians may be losing both dominance and their majority status. We're talking to...
That's well put.
Robert, thank you. I stole it from your book. Robert Jones is the author of The End of White Christian America. Robert, you write that the death of white Christian America could actually revitalize American politics. How might that happen?
Well, I do think there's been this sense of a kind of, you know, captured a captivity by partisan politics. And what we see in the political science literature is that the power of partisanship has really taken off in the last few decades, or the same kind of period I'm looking at these changes. And that one of the things that's happening is that, you know, religious groups have been sort of divided and ripped apart, really, by their kind of partisan allegiances. And there's been this kind of resorting. And I think when you have a kind of powerful demographic, there's a real temptation to do that. And I think one of the openings that may happen here, as, you know, particularly kind of white evangelicals who have tended to vote 7 and 8 or 8 and 10 for Republican candidates, they still look like that's going to happen this year, interestingly enough. But one opportunity here, as a group sort of moves from being a kind of dominant cultural group that is sort of exerting all this political power to a more minority group, is that there may be an opportunity to rethink that relationship to power. And I think that could be a real opportunity. Because when we ask young people today why they've left churches, one of the things we hear is too much involvement in partisan politics. And so I think the chance for churches to rethink that might be a way to be able to reach back out to some of these young people that have left.
More specifically, how do you see the decline of white Christian America affecting the Republican Party in particular?
Yeah. Well, the real challenge, I think, and I'm not the first one to sort of point this out. In fact, the Republican National Committee was the first one to point this out right after the 2012 election, Romney's loss, that this, what I call in the book, the white Christian strategy of trying to pile up supermajorities of white Christian voters to offset these other growing segments of society among Latino voters, non-religious voters, it's in the long term a losing strategy. I mean, I argue in the book that Romney's campaign was the last one that this was going to be even a plausible strategy. But surprisingly enough, I think with the selection of Pence as VP choice, that Trump has actually kind of doubled down on this white Christian strategy. So we may have a real test case ahead of us about whether this is viable or not. I have my real doubts because it is a diminishing pool of voters that the Republican Party in particular continues to be relying on. Real quickly, just Mitt Romney was 8 in 10 of Mitt Romney's coalition were made up of white Christian voters compared to only 37% of Barack Obama's coalition in the 2012 elections. That's just not a viable strategy for the future.
What implications do you see the decline of white Christian America having on religion and Christianity in particular?
Well, you know, I think if we go back to these buildings I was talking about earlier, you know, there was this sense that, you know, first just a single denomination, then maybe like a single group of denominations that were predominantly white could exert kind of power. And one of the things I think is influence in public life is going to have to be wielded much more informally and in coalitions. So I think, you know, gone are the days when a kind of white Protestant denomination or even a group of them could jump out and lead up a parade and just expect everybody to kind of fall in line. I think it's going to be much more the case that religious organizations, white Christian organizations, to exert a lot of power and or influence, not just power, but influence in American public life, they're going to need some partners. And I think that's going to change. And when you ask for partners, those partners are going to ask you to think hard about their issues. And I think that is going to be a new conversation that we really haven't had.
Yeah, I mean, religion has been, in many respects, a way for people who are very different from each other in other respects to understand each other and respect each other's needs. I mean, really the only locus of support for immigration reform on the Republican side of this country comes from the evangelical community.
Yes, that's right. You know, we've had a lot of leadership from the Southern Baptist Convention, for example, you know, first with Richard Land and then with Russell Moore at the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. There have been, you know, fairly outspoken about the need for a comprehensive immigration reform that includes the path to citizenship. But those kind of line crossing areas, the other places are things like raising the minimum wage or paid family leave for health emergencies. These are places where these lines could be crossed and that religious organizations have really taken the lead.
Right. And the decline of Christianity, though, among white voters could, in effect, take away those bridges. And it's notable to me that we have seen, along with this decline phenomenon that you've been documenting, a rise of a libertarian wing of the Republican Party that is to a great extent comprised of young, usually male, white atheists. And those are the people who oppose these kinds of things that we're talking about, immigration reform, social welfare, most vociferously.
You know, there is that faction, but it's important. Our most recent data still shows about half of Republicans supporting a path to citizenship, for example, for immigrants, despite the kind of rhetoric that we see from the Trump campaign and sometimes from the top of the leadership and Republicans. So I think there's this kind of rank and file, you know, thing. One challenge, though, I think for churches that I think that this decline is going to force them to reckon with in a way that they really haven't is the issue of race. You know, Martin Luther King said 11 a.m. on Sunday morning was the most segregated hour in America, and it's largely still true. But I do think that these bridges, and because there are going to be a need for more coalition kinds of organizing, I think this may provide some opportunity for more of those bridges to be built.
Well, Robert, in our last minute here, do you see any chance that the trend lines might reverse direction? Is white Christian America headed toward an inevitable decline? Where might that trend line level out and plateau?
Well, you know, nothing's inevitable, but I think all of the signs point to this trend really continuing. I mean, given that it's based on these big kind of macro seismic shifts of birth rates, immigration patterns, and disaffiliation, and there's nothing in any of those patterns that really points to a reversal. So I think that, you know, it's really important that white Christians are really going to have to come to terms with the changing country, change from a majority white Christian country to a minority white Christian country, and their place in it.
That's Robert Jones. He's the CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute and author of the new book, The End of White Christian America. Robert, it was great talking to you. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And listeners, we want to hear from you on this. What do you make of the decline of white Christian America? And in particular, what do you make of the decline of the white Christian South? Are you noticing it? What does it mean to you? How do you think it will affect life in our part of the country in the decades to come? You can tweet us at OST Talk, or you can call us at 404-500-9457. We would love to get some of your comments onto the air in tomorrow's show. On yesterday's show, we celebrated the 20th anniversary of the Atlanta Olympic Games, and now another look at how memory of that event is still alive and well in the city. Back in 1996, the Varsity Drive-In in downtown Atlanta was ground zero for Olympic pin trading. But the trading didn't stop when the Olympic flame was extinguished. A dedicated group keeps the tradition going with monthly meetings at the fast food landmark. They gather there to buy, sell, and trade the little metal trinkets. GPB's Sam Whitehead stopped by a recent meeting with a floppy pin-covered hat to see what's keeping collectors coming after all these years.
What's happening? Olympic Pin Show. When? Third Wednesday of the month. Time? 4 o'clock to 7-ish. Olympic lapel pins, sports pins and all kinds, Olympic-related items, all kinds of stuff.
If you were at the Olympic Games and you were wearing this floppy hat, it's an open invitation to any other pin collector to come up to a perfect stranger and say, would you like to trade one of your pins? Randy Parsons. Let's see, there's probably maybe 30 or 40 pins on here. This was a special pin. It says Centennial Olympic Stadium. These are kind of very common, just the ones with Atlanta generics with a runner or somebody doing a different sport. Oh, this is an interesting pin. I'd have to get my glasses out for that one. It looks like either Portugal. Oh, Swaziland. It's even better. I would say the Swaziland is probably the best pin you have, even though it's the smallest one you have on your hat. You know, this could be easily a $10 pin, $20 maximum. It's all about, is there a price guide? No. And do they go up in value? Very rarely. They normally go down in value. So don't think you're going to go buy all these pins and make a lot of money. As I said, and I love, I give away a lot of pins. So I'll give you one before we leave. I'll make sure. Just because I have so many.
One of the guys here has told me that this has been, he's had a lot of hard times in life, and he said just knowing he can come here and do this has really meant a lot to him. There are a lot of people like that where this is not the biggest part of their life, certainly, just a small thing, but it's kind of a security blanket, an anchor. Okay. I'm Scott Reed. We're here as part of the monthly pin trading group started out in the Atlanta Olympics in 1996. Most people here are not finding new pins, although sometimes people do, but that's not what people expect to do. It's more social now. People know each other. They it's a place they can come and just relax around people and get away from the pressures of the day and not have any expectations or general life pressures, and it's just a good place to socialize. There are people that come that have never been here before, but for the most part, the people that are here have been coming for 20 years. One of them's mother was a big collector and passed away a few years ago from cancer, and she's here looking to sell her mom's collection.
Since she passed away, it's hard for me to look at them, so it's kind of, I'm kind of weaning myself back into it.
My name's Elena Parada, and I am trying to sell a little bit of my mom's collection when she was alive. We spent a lot of time together with this. This is her passion, and I was a mama's girl, so I did everything she did. So
I could tell you when we were together, I could tell you in the price of every single one of her pins. So I have a very small collection at home that's very personal to me. Her Italian pins and her most of her equestrian pins. It meant so much to her that it's kind of taking away a piece of, like, I don't know. It's hard. She spent so much time collecting them and organizing them and trading them. It meant a lot to her, just like it means a lot to everybody here. So
you can see photos of pins and the collector's meeting at the Varsity at gpbnews.org. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in today for Celeste Headlee. Charlie Chaplin is a name that most people know. His legacy as a pioneer of early cinema is firmly cemented in history alongside of others like D.W. Griffith and Victor Fleming. But African-American filmmakers who created in the same time period as those three white guys that I mentioned are often forgotten. My next guest wants to change that. Atlanta filmmaker Brett Wood has compiled a collection of so-called race films that go back to the silent era. Turner Classic Movies is going to feature some of those over the next couple of Sundays. And Brett Woods joins us in the studio now. Hi, Brett.
How are you?
Well, first of all, what's a race film? That's a curious term.
Well, it was a film made primarily between the World Wars from the 1910s through the 1940s, featuring African-American performers and more often than not made by black filmmakers. And they were made to be exhibited in theaters that catered to black audiences.
Is race film a term that they would have used at the time, or is that historians looking back and applying that label in retrospect?
Yeah, I think race films or race movies is the term that it's pretty universal. And even though now we say African-American cinema, race films or race movies is still an acceptable term.
Okay. Why start this collection, Brett? On first inspection, you seem to be a white guy. What's your connection to this stuff?
I've always been fascinated by films that haven't been given their proper due in the whole narrative of American film history. I've always been interested in silent films, films that are lost, films that orphan films that were not made by the studios or that were made by independent filmmakers. So that whole idea of unearthing an underappreciated film is all a key part of what I do as a producer of Blu-rays and DVDs.
Let's just go ahead and jump right into a clip here. And folks, these are really old movies. The audio is not always great, so put on your best listening ears. One of the films, Brett, that you feature in this collection, it's 1931's Hot Biscuits. It's a short comedy about a rivalry between two men who compete against each other in a high-stakes game of mini golf. Let's listen to a scene from Hot Biscuits.
Hey, what's your name anyhow, old joker?
My name is Biscuit. Just plain old Hot Biscuit. Now, if you know anybody that wants to play some 10-cent coon hand, send them right down the street here to my shining stand. Because I'll play anybody, brother. Just tell them to come down there and ask for Biscuit.
That ain't a way to spell biscuit.
Oh, that's the way we spell it in Atlanta.
That film, virtually unseen for more than 80 years, and it's not just because nobody wanted to see it. It couldn't be found. How did you come across it?
Well, it's interesting, and I checked again last night, and it's still not on the Internet Movie Database, which supposedly has every movie
ever made.
But it's one of these, almost lost films that we rediscovered. It was lost even though it was sort of hiding at the Library of Congress. What happened is one of the curators of the collection, Jacqueline Stewart, really wanted us to include it. And we said, well, this film doesn't seem to exist. And she said, no, it's at the Library of Congress, trust me. So I contacted the Library of Congress and they searched their database. Let's search Biscuits. Couldn't find the film. And they're like, we don't think this film exists. And fortunately, she had taken a photo of the title screen back when she saw it in the 90s. And we realized it's spelled Biscuits is spelled B-I-S-K-I-T-S. Therefore, no one could find it at the Library of Congress. It was just hiding in the database somewhere. So,
yeah, but that's how we spell it in Atlanta.
Exactly. But, you know, and then what do you know? We sort of rediscovered a film that most people have never heard of and most people didn't think had survived.
We'll listen to another clip from another film in just a second here. But these films, as you say, Brett, primarily starring African Americans, made by African Americans, made for an African American
right.
audience. Such films have trouble getting funding to be made today. I can't imagine in the 20s or the 30s. Where did the money come from? Did the studios pay for these films?
No, strictly independently financed. Some companies were bigger than others, were a little bit better organized than others, but they were all made well below the technical and economic level of even a Hollywood B picture. I mean, these are really low-budget endeavors. And it's a testament to the entrepreneurship
oh, yeah.
of the filmmakers and the fact that they were so well organized in not only the film production, but distribution and exhibition.
So if we think back to the 1930s, the early 20th century, the Great Migration is what's happening in Black America, right?
Right.
Black people moving from our part of the country, from a rural lifestyle in the South, up to major cities in the North to work in factories. One of the films in your collection that touches on the urban migration is called Birthright. It's from 1938. It's about a Harvard graduate who returns to his Southern home to create an all-Black school. Here's a clip of that film. It's from someone in that community who doesn't want this to happen. He doesn't want this Harvard grad to start this all-Black school back in his Southern hometown.
White folks and Negroes got along pretty well around here till you got back from school. But since you got back, a lot of unpleasant things have been happening. Now, there ain't room in this here town for the white folks and educated Negro like you. So if I was you, I'd just drift on away quietly, Peter. Quietly.
Now, the film's director there, a gentleman named Oscar Michaud, apparently had strong feelings about the need for African-American communities to establish strong centers of
right.
rural life. Why did he feel that way at this time in the 30s?
He had actually began as a homesteader, as a farmer in the Midwest, and eventually moved to the city to sort of raise money to continue this, and became a novelist, and then became a filmmaker. And even though he was an urbanite, he still had this compulsion to return to the land. And so he made films that sort of encouraged African Americans to return to the South or return to the Midwest and be farmers and start schools and sort of build those communities. Part of the urban migration allowed city centers to emerge that allowed African Americans the chance to have, you know, a new level of wealth and sort of to incubate Black culture in a lot of ways. But at the same time, these communities had their downsides, and you see that a lot in the films where there's crime and there's corruption. And so, you know, Michaud would never really say one is better than the other, but the land for him was always the hope. It was the future. It was the place where he felt like African Americans could build new communities that hopefully didn't have the sort of the dangers and pitfalls of the city.
My guest is Atlanta filmmaker and producer Brett Wood. He is behind a new collection of early movies by Black filmmakers. It's called Pioneers of African American Cinema, and Turner Classic Movies is going to highlight some of these films from your collection later this month. Were all of these films, Brett, generally, did they have social messages? Were they serious films in that respect, or was there just some silly light entertainment?
Well, that's one of the big revelations about the series, is that they're all over the place. In a good way, it shows that there's a diversity of subject matter. Michaud, he was the guy who would tackle the issues head on and make things that confronted racism from the white community, but also he would talk about racism within the Black community. But then on the other end of the spectrum, you'll have a pure entertainment, a film like The Flying Ace, which is an aviation serial in 6 episodes. Hmm. And then you'll have The Bronze Buckaroo, which is a Black cast Western. So it's all over the place. It runs the gamut, and to me, that's an important thing to recognize about the films, is it's not just you're going to see the same film over and over made by different filmmakers. It's as diverse as the films that were coming out of Hollywood. And I think in a lot of ways more interesting, because they could say things that were not being checked by the censors and the studio brass.
Yeah.
And they felt like they were speaking to the black community, they didn't really expect a lot of white viewers to be watching these films, so they could speak a little more openly about politics within the black community that they wouldn't say if they were making films for a white audience.
Here's a very different film that is also on that same topic of the urban migration. It's part of a 1941 film called The Blood of Jesus. It's the first feature by director-actor Spencer Williams, who is known today as Andy on TV's Amos and Andy. This film is about a woman who goes on a spiritual journey after accidentally being shot by her husband. Here's a scene featuring the woman being guided by an angel who tells her where to go in the hereafter.
That road leads to the highway of life. There, at the crossroads, you will find that which you seek. The road to the right leads to happiness and eternal life. The road to the left leads to death, hell, and destruction. Be on your way, but walk clear of temptation and beware of the hypocrite and the false prophet.
In this film, Brett, the woman's spirit follows an angel to heaven, and she also follows an agent for Satan to hell. In this case, hell is a jazz club in the city. This is, again, a differentiation between urban and rural living. How did the film's writer-director Spencer Williams cover that debate? Is it almost like The Rake's Progress?
Well, Spencer Williams had a more humanistic view of religion and sin than, say, someone like Oscar Michaud, who is very judgmental. In Spencer Williams's world, you could go to the juke joint, this hell on earth, and actually have a pretty good time.
Ah, I see.
And still get up Sunday morning and go to church and not feel too bad about it. So, to
but
him,
he's still portraying it as hell, though.
I like to think of it as more of a way station on the path to hell, where there's some pretty good music and tasty beverages.
Okay. One of the fascinating finds in your collection, Brett, is it's a 1925 silent film starring this iconic film and stage actor.
Sweet soul, take heed of perjury. Thou art on thy deathbed.
To die?
Aye, presently. Therefore confess thee freely of thy sin. Thou art to die.
Wow. So that's Paul Robeson from a 1944 performance of Othello. Paul Robeson, legend, very probably maybe the really famous first famous black actor, I mean to say. Obviously, that's not from the silent film. We can't really do silent film on the radio. Sorry, folks. You actually came across Robeson's first film performance, a 1925 silent movie called Body and Soul. Robeson apparently did not acknowledge this film until later in his career. What's up with that?
Honestly, the films of Oscar Michaud were never widely accepted. And to be honest, I'll expand the focus here a little bit. These films were not really considered important for decades. And even among the black community, they were, to us, to white viewers, they were curiosity items. To the black community, they were not the best representation of what they wanted African-American culture to be like. And so years later, Paul Robeson wouldn't list this in his filmography. And there was not a lot of crossover from these films to Hollywood films. If you made films like this, you did a few of them, and then your career was pretty much over. And I think it was Spencer Williams is an exception, and I think that's because he had established himself in entertainment first before he began directing these films in the 1940s.
Let's try to squeeze in a couple more clips.
Sure.
The films of Oscar Michaud, who we talked about earlier, explore the complexities of being African-American and having personal relationships in that context. In the 1932 film Veiled Aristocrats, a young African-American woman is torn between a successful light-skinned man and an idealistic entrepreneur with a darker complexion. Here's a scene where she explains her frustrations to the light-skinned man.
You grew up and went through school as a white boy, so that by the time you were old enough to go with girls, you had forgotten your childhood days. It wasn't a case of being suddenly picked up and placed in a new and strenuous environment as you have placed me. I'm afraid to talk, to smile, to do anything, for fear that I'll make a mistake.
And then elsewhere in the film, we hear about the resistance to dating black women in this film. This is 1938's Birthright that we're listening to.
Listen, Peter, you don't want to do what's on your mind.
What's on my mind?
Marry a negress. You don't want to marry a negress.
Not marry a negress?
No, Peter, no. For yourself, it may make no difference, but your children, think of your children. Your son's growing up under a brown veil, a veil that you can't tear off, that God himself can't tear off.
So that makes me uncomfortable listening to that right now, Brett. Is this a series of films that if people catch some of these films on Turner Classic, are they going to be made to feel uncomfortable a lot?
No, I don't think so, because Oscar Michaud, who made both of these films, kind of reels it in and sort of, he does a great job of humanizing these issues and bringing them to a resolution that kind of makes sense and are emotionally satisfying. Both films are made by Michaud, and I should mention that both of them don't exist in their entirety, and that was an important part of this entire collection is... Just because a film, in the case of Birthright, is missing its first two reels, in the case of Veiled Aristocrats is missing its first reel, and you can hear the sound quality is terrible. For that reason, these films have never been out on video before.
What a shame.
So this is our chance to, like, just because they're technically inferior doesn't mean they should stay locked away in an archive somewhere.
Absolutely. Good work on it. That is Atlanta filmmaker and producer Brett Wood. He's behind a new collection of works by early African-American filmmakers. It is called Pioneers of African-American Cinema. As we said, Turner Classic Movies is going to be highlighting some of those films over the next couple of Sundays. Brett, thank you so much for being here and bringing us these films.
That was a pleasure.
And before we go, folks, we've got a quick update to a story that we've been reporting on for a while. A North Georgia newspaper publisher and his attorney have finally been cleared of felony charges in a case that has raised some serious First Amendment questions. Mark Thomason of the Fan and Focus newspaper was arrested last month after he filed an open records request wanting to see canceled checks written by two area judges. One of those judges pushed for the charges, saying that she worried Thomason was going to misuse her personal banking information, because that's how that works. You can totally arrest someone for something they might do possibly in the future. But anyway, after intense public scrutiny, the judge requested the charges be dropped, but another judge declined to do so until a hearing earlier this week. And that's unusual. When a plaintiff backs down, usually the judge just signs the form and drops the charges without a hearing. Thomason says that hearing lasted for a couple of hours, though ultimately the charges were dismissed. He says that he's thinking about filing a lawsuit over his arrest. For more on that story out of Fannin County, you can read the latest reporting at gpbnews.org. And that's our show for the today. Put it, the conversation with you continues 24/7. We will have more movie talk on tomorrow's show when we feature a pair of documentaries from the Macon Film Festival. What's the most memorable movie that you've ever caught at a festival? Could be a small event or a big bash like Sundance. Just want to hear about your experiences. Call us at 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk. We're on Facebook.com/On Second Thought Radio for today. That is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusea. Have a great day.